KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
President Trump announces a ceasefire between Israel and Iran, though neither country has confirmed. This just hours after retaliatory strikes against the U.S., missiles fired at a U.S. base in the Middle East. Today is Monday, June 23rd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang with Ari Shapiro. This hour, Trump heads to the NATO summit in The Hague. The two main topics will be Iran and the demand that member countries increase defense spending.
What are we going to cut? Are we going to raise taxes? Are we going to cut education? But we're going to have to meet these defense spending goals.
Later, how changing asylum policies play out at an immigration court in Phoenix. And an old ship is about to become an artificial reef off of Florida's panhandle, and divers are getting excited.
I feel like we're going to have enough interest that we're going to have like multiple trips there a week, I hope.
Plus, the NBA has a new champion, the Oklahoma City Thunder. Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Moments after President Trump tweeted that Iran and Israel agreed to a ceasefire, though neither country has confirmed this yet, Vice President Vance told Fox News that Trump wants to work on a long-term settlement between the two countries. Vance says he thinks Iranians are at a place where they don't want to keep on fighting.
What the Iranians have showed through their support of terror networks, through their now failed effort to build a nuclear weapon, is that they're just not very good at war. And I think the president really hit the reset button and said, look, let's actually produce long-term peace for the region.
This after Iran fired several missiles at a U.S. airbase in Qatar in retaliation for the U.S. bombing three of Iran's nuclear sites over the weekend. But Trump says the U.S. was warned in advance and there are no reports of casualties. Meanwhile, another way Iran could retaliate is by closing the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow waterway. It's a vital pathway for the world energy supplies. And Pierce Kat Lonsdorf has more.
Around 20% of the world's oil and natural gas goes through the Strait of Hormuz. A full closure, which has never happened before, would have a major impact on energy markets around the world. Iran's parliament has voted to close the strait, according to Iranian state TV. The move would still require approval from Iran's top security council. But closing it would also hurt Iran's economy, since its oil also passes through. Energy experts tell NPR a more likely scenario would be Iran carrying out covert actions in the strait against certain ships without completely halting trade. The price of crude oil has fluctuated in recent days, and insurance for ships making the journey has gone up. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
A new generation of obesity medicines is in the works. A study shows promising results for an experimental pill that works like the blockbusters Ozempic and Wegovy. NPR's Sydney Lupkin has more.
Eli Lilly is developing a pill called Orforglipron. In a study of patients with type 2 diabetes, it lowered blood sugar. Patients on the highest dose lost an average of 16 pounds. The results were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The study compared the experimental pills to placebo, followed more than 550 people, and lasted 40 weeks. Some patients experienced gastrointestinal issues when they increased their doses, but no episodes of low blood sugar called hypoglycemia. This was not a head-to-head study of orforglipron compared to already approved injectable obesity drugs like Novo Nordisk's Wegovy, but the safety and effectiveness appeared to be similar. Eli Lilly says it plans to submit orforglipron for regulatory approval for obesity by the end of the year. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are trading higher at this hour. Dow and S&P 500 futures are up about 0.5%. NASDAQ futures are up about 0.75%. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court is letting the Trump administration resume rapid deportations of certain migrants to countries where they have no ties, pausing a federal judge's ruling that they have to be given an opportunity to challenge their removal. This in response to an emergency request by the administration that will stay in place while legal challenges make their way through the lower courts. The order focused on a flight of 8 men held at a U.S. military base in Djibouti to South Sudan. The Trump administration says the men are violent criminals. Taiwan's president is insisting the Democratic Island is a country and has the history to prove it. That's prompting condemnation from China, which called his comments, quote, hearsay. NPR's Emily Fang has more.
Taiwan's President Lai Ching-te said that, quote, Taiwan is, of course, a country. He made the comments as part of a speech, which itself is one of a series of 10 lectures planned along the theme of uniting the country. Taiwan is in the midst of a highly partisan political battle and its legislature at the moment. China then hit back at the speech, saying President Lai was guilty of hostility and provocation towards China. The two governments in Taiwan and China are rival authorities, each claiming overlapping territories under their jurisdiction. And China considers the island of Taiwan its territory and has committed itself repeatedly to one day controlling the island, even if that means invading Taiwan. Emily Fang, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Today, Iran struck back, firing missiles at a U.S. base in Qatar. Qatar says its air defenses successfully intercepted those missiles, which targeted a base where thousands of U.S. troops are stationed. There are no reports of U.S. casualties. This, of course, comes in the wake of the U.S. directly inserting itself into Israel's war with Iran, bombing three Iranian nuclear sites over the weekend. And here's a twist. President Trump has thanked Iran for giving the U.S. advance notice of the missile attacks today. I want to bring in two of the many NPR reporters tracking threads of this conflict. Ayah Batraoui is on the ground for us in Dubai. Hey there, Ayah.
Hi.
Hi. And Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman is reporting here in Washington. Tom, I'm going to give you the first question. What more details do we have on these missile strikes by Iran?
Well, a defense official said more than 10 or so short and medium-range missiles fired from Iran. All were shot down by air defenses and, again, no casualties. Qatar's foreign ministry denounced the attack. They said came from Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, calling it a flagrant violation of the country's sovereignty and airspace. We do know that there was a shelter-in-place order before the attacks, and also all U.S. bases in the region were placed on higher alert. Now, Iran claims it also fired a missile or missiles at a base in Iraq, but the Pentagon had no reports of that. Iraq has closed its airspace and also had no reports there of any missiles fired.
Yeah, Batraoui on the ground for us in the region. Just situate us, this attack on Qatar. How significant is that? That is a Gulf Arab state. It is friendly with the U.S. Trump just visited last month.
Yeah, we've never seen an attack targeting U.S. troops in Qatar before. You know, Qatar walks a really fine line in the Gulf. It does share the world's biggest underwater gas field with Iran. And a few years ago, if you recall, when Arab neighbors did cut ties with Qatar, closed their ports and Qatar's only border to it, Iran was one of the first countries that rushed to send over food and other vitals to Qatar. And so, yeah, Qatar was given an advance notice. It did that highly unusual step of closing its airspace for 2 hours before the attack and then was able to shoot down those missiles. But, you know, also Qatar's leadership does have those close ties with Trump and his Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff. You know, Trump was just in the Gulf, as you mentioned, only last month, meeting with Gulf rulers. You know, he was also offered a Boeing aircraft to replace one of his older Air Force Ones by Qatar. But what this attack does is it really just draws in more countries to this conflict as a result of what began as Israel's attack on Iran 10 days ago. Countries across the region rushed to condemn in very strongly worded statements Iran's attack tonight and warned of this spiraling out of control.
Spiraling out of control. Although, Tom Bowman, this is not entirely unexpected. It was just precisely this kind of retaliatory attack from Iran that U.S. officials were worried about after they joined the fight over the weekend.
Absolutely. This is a main concern. There were some 40,000 U.S. personnel spread at bases all over the Middle East. And again, they are all on heightened alert because of the attacks from the U.S. as well as Israel during the more than a week or so. Now, at some of these locations, including the U.S. naval base at Bahrain, military dependents left more than a week ago, and also satellite photos have shown both U.S. aircraft and ships leaving so they wouldn't be sitting ducks. Now, it's interesting to note, as Aya pointed out, that the attacks on Al Udeid were telegraphed by Iran to Qatar. So is this simply messaging? Basically, Iran had to respond and do something because of the attacks on the nuclear facilities. But this was a very limited strike. I was talking with one retired senior officer who said, listen, Iran had three choices: do nothing, go in with massive missile strikes, or mount something limited, which is what we see here. But Mary Louise, we're in the middle of this right now. Will this be it? Will more bases be attacked? We just don't know. It's too early.
Yeah, so many questions still to answer. Among those questions, Aya, circle back to something you just said about the concern of drawing more countries into the conflict. Does it seem that the U.S. decision to bomb Iran may have widened the conflict, inadvertently drawn Gulf Arab states that would have been happy to sit on the sidelines, drawn them right into this?
Yes, and this is exactly what they did not want to see happen. They do not want war or to be part of Israel's reshaping of the region of the Middle East. You know, when Qatar condemned that attack on Iran, it also said in that same statement they've long been warning against Israel's escalations in the region. So clearly linking that with today's attack. I've also been speaking with people in the Gulf who say the leaders here see the utility of Israel, backed by the U.S., obviously degrading Iran's nuclear enrichment and its missile program. But this war directly threatens them now. They don't want to see regime changing chaos ensue in a country the size and scope of Iran. You know, the U.S. history in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Israel's ongoing war in Gaza and the humanitarian catastrophe there and the crisis there, these are not seen as successes in the Middle East. Also, I'm here in Dubai. You know, this place relies on foreign investment, tourism, you know, booming real estate markets for its survival. We saw flights being canceled tonight through Dubai, the world's busiest for international transits, and suspension of air travel over not just Qatar, but also Bahrain and Kuwait.
And what should we make of this Trump from President Trump, this post from President Trump just coming through on social media, thanking Iran, saying thanks for giving us early notice, which made it possible for no lives to be lost, nobody to be injured. Does the fact that Iran gave advance messaging perhaps signal an attack to an attempt to strike back, preserve dignity, but not ratchet things up further?
Yeah, so Trump says he hopes that, you know, Iran, quote, gets this out of their system now. You know, the thing is, this was measured by all degrees. This was a measured response. You know, I spoke with Badr Saif, a Kuwaiti academic and professor, just after Iran's attack towards this expansive air base in Qatar, and he called this a face-saving measure by Iran. Have a listen.
My preference is not to have the Gulf in the middle of it all, but I think they had, their choices were limited. And going after infrastructure, as opposed to humans, as opposed to civilians, hotspots, as opposed to closing Hormuz, right? I think that's the least damaging. Very damaging still, but among the suite of options that they have, it's the least damaging.
Yeah, so what he's saying here is that this attack is damaging to Gulf relations with Iran, but it did not produce casualties, and Iran didn't pull the trigger of trying to shut down the Strait of Hormuz, which is that narrow waterway between Iran and the United Arab Emirates, where a fifth of the world's oil and gas passes through. And he notes the U.S. attack, while unprecedented and also severe on Iran, was very targeted. So he says, look, this could end here, but also the risk of miscalculation in this expanding is still very high. The region is really on edge.
Tom Bowman, pick up on that. How worried is the U.S. about Iran attempting to close the strait?
No, there's great concern about that. Some 20% of the world's oil moves through the strait and into the Arabian Sea. You could see Iran attack oil tankers, maybe try mining the strait. Uh-huh. But at this point, Mary Louise, it's mostly talk.
NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman and NPR international correspondent Aya Batraoui in Dubai. Thanks to both of you. After speaking with our correspondents, President Trump said that Israel and Iran have agreed to a ceasefire. Neither country has confirmed that.
All right, changing gears now. Scuba divers may soon add an iconic ocean liner to their bucket lists. The SS United States is a retired luxury ship that last sailed in 1969. Later this year, it could become an artificial reef in the waters off the Florida Panhandle. Designed to be sleek and unsinkable, it still holds the crown for the fastest transatlantic crossing. For many, it also brings nostalgia for a time when travel was glamorous. Alabama Public Radio's Corey Young reports.
This is where there'd be shuffleboard and tennis and other things. When they
Alex Fogg is Natural Resources Chief for Okaloosa County, Florida. He's in charge of overseeing the SS United States transition from ocean liner to the world's largest artificial reef.
As we're walking down the promenade, stay on the left side of the green line.
Passengers crossing the Atlantic once took in the ocean view from the promenade deck. Today, the ship is in Mobile, Alabama, where workers are prepping the luxury liner for its next life, under the sea. Fog stands on the ship's rust-covered, decaying deck, pointing out vacant window frames where people in wetsuits will soon catch sight of marine life.
So very much accessible to divers. They'll be able to swim down this hallway and go in and out of the windows at any time.
And divers can't wait. Savannah Christie is the owner of Scuba Tech in Destin. She says since word broke last fall that the ship would become an artificial reef off Florida's panhandle, she's been fielding calls and emails from as far away as the UK.
They wanted to know, when was it going to sink? Can they watch? Can they be the first to dive it? How do they sign up? How deep is it going to be? Just all the things.
The idea is to sink the ship 20 nautical miles offshore to a depth of 180 feet. If it sinks upright, the top decks will be 50 to 60 feet below the surface, making it accessible to all levels of divers.
I feel like we're going to have enough interest that we're going to have like multiple trips there a week, I hope.
The ocean liner is the length of 3 football fields. Eventually, there could be lots of room for marine life to thrive. That also makes for great fishing, says charter boat captain Josh Calhoun.
You can probably have 20, 30 boats on it and people won't be fighting. There'll be plenty of room for people to fish it.
The SS United States would be the largest reef of its kind, but not the only one. Many coastal states sink old boats, oil rigs, and even subway cars. Fogg says it's good for both the ecosystem and coastal economies. He's counting on the new reef to bring a big return. The $10 million the county is prepared to spend on it, he says, will be offset by the money visitors bring.
Probably going to be on the order of $3 to $5 million per year in direct economic impact to hotels, to fuel sales, to restaurants, to all the things that people spend money on when they come to a destination.
Ogallala County wants to sink the SS United States toward the end of this year, but a New York preservation group is suing to stop the move. They want to bring the ship to Brooklyn as an attraction. Dive shop owner Christy hopes it will sink as planned, and if it does, she'll be there to watch.
I'd love to dive it the day it goes down, if not maybe the day after.
And for all those people who call and email, she's keeping a list. For NPR News, I'm Corey Young in Mobile, Alabama.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump is implementing some of the most restrictive immigration policies of the modern era during his second term. More than 200,000 migrants have been removed from the U.S. since January. But the ideas behind his immigration policies are not new. They were pushed for decades by hard right advocates on the fringes, including by a man named Dan Stein. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran looks at the career of this influential immigration hardliner.
They might sound like radical new ideas, but for years, Dan Stein has pushed Republican presidents to end automatic citizenship for children born in the U.S. to parents with temporary or no legal status. Here's Stein on C-SPAN in 1989, advocating for border security and mass deportations.
Most Americans sleep at night thinking we have the borders under control, unaware of the fact that at this point, we do not. The more people you naturalize, the more relative petitions you get. It's like shoveling snow in a blizzard.
Fast forward 36 years, and Stein's efforts to play the long game appear to have paid off. Here's Trump celebrating his first 100 days.
Democrats have vowed mass invasion and mass migration. We are delivering mass deportation, and it's happening very fast.
Through executive orders, Trump is enacting many of the policies Stein has long championed. For nearly four decades, Stein led FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, a think tank in Washington, D.C. that has consistently pressed for immigration restrictions. Birthright citizenship is a good example. Trump's effort to end it is being challenged in the courts. But Stein is elated. The debate has gone from fringe legal theory all the way to the Supreme Court.
Everything about what Donald Trump is trying to do right now is make up for lost time.
Stein's time at FAIR has come to an end. He retired in April. He met with us to talk about his legacy. Throughout his long tenure at FAIR, Stein argued things that have been largely debunked by most mainstream economists and researchers. Stein argued illegal immigration is a burden on American taxpayers, makes the country less safe, and leads to job loss and depressed wages.
The reason why I believe FAIR has been so effective under my leadership is simply related to the fact that we're able to spin out, and this is one of the gifts I have, the implications of what a policy will do over time based on past experience, how something will ramify.
But FAIR and Stein for a long time were influential mainly on the fringes. So it's fair to ask, were Stein's decades of lobbying actually successful?
Was it effective back then? I'm sorry to say, but no one was listening.
That's John Rowe, one of Stein's fellow anti-immigration advocates who's known and collaborated with him since the 1980s.
I was there, and all that would happen is there would be demonization, there would be hostility, and Dan had to endure a lot of that.
Now more people are listening. Some of Stein's staffers are in positions of power and have the ear of the White House. FAIR's former government relations director, Robert Law, has been nominated for a senior post at the Department of Homeland Security. FAIR's current executive director, Julie Kirchner, served as a senior official at DHS on immigration issues in Trump's first term. And Stein, in his retirement, is hoping they help carry out even stricter restrictions, including a strict cap on any legal immigration. And he'd like to see the highly popular Uniting for Ukraine program, currently suspended, permanently ended. It allowed Ukrainians fleeing war to temporarily seek refuge in the U.S.
Some of them are here, young women, and they're out there in California, you know, trying to make themselves stars on OnlyFans. Well, you know, the men are in battle in Ukraine, and like these refugees seem to be doing pretty well in this country.
First, his story of inflammatory comments landed it on a list of anti-immigrant hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center in 2008. Caleb Kiefer, a senior research analyst with the Law Center, says, like Trump, Stein has long vilified immigrants and asylum seekers.
FAIR works to kind of maintain this veneer of legitimacy, but then when you really start to kind of peel back their decades-long history, what you find is ugliness, xenophobia, ties to white nationalists, ties to eugenics.
First founder, ophthalmologist John Tanton, pushed for white nationalist policies, including encouraging only certain people with, quote, positive traits to reproduce, what is called passive eugenics. For decades, Stein had close ties to Tanton, first as his press secretary and later leading FAIR. Stein sees backlash as part of the job.
You don't achieve a certain level of influence without being criticized.
Stein is staying active in immigration debates and is cheering on Trump's ongoing crackdown, even as he finds himself with more free time.
There's so much to this story. Eventually, I'm sure I'll write more on it once I get a little chance to complete my cooking classes and get back to the trombone.
Things he can now do after some of his anti-immigration ideas have gone from obscure to policy in the United States. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Rockville, Maryland.
All right, the NBA has a new champion, the Oklahoma City Thunder. Last night, they beat the Indiana Pacers in Game 7 of the finals and brought home their very first title since the team's move to Oklahoma City. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan joins us now. Hey, Becky.
Hey, Elsa.
All right, let's start with Oklahoma City because this team, like, won only, what, 20-something games a few seasons ago? And now they're here on top?
Yeah.
How did they do it?
Yeah, I think what this team, the Thunder, have done as a franchise is so impressive. Just incredibly savvy team building. Just for one example, their star, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, was drafted initially by another team and had this, like, promising but not mind-blowing rookie season. But Oklahoma City saw so much potential that they went out and got him in a trade, and he has since blossomed into the league's most valuable player, leading scorer this past season. So great trades like that, great drafting. They acquire a lot of draft picks. Mark Daigneault, their coach, has talked about how Oklahoma City, too, the city itself, makes a difference. It's a small market, and there's just less pressure, he says. Fans and media are more supportive. They have a very young team, and young players can grow and make mistakes that any young player does, but still feel supported, he says. And I think that's a big difference maker, too.
Yeah. Well, can we also talk about the injury that changed Game 7? Like, what happened to Tyrese Haliburton?
Yeah, he's the point guard of the Pacers, really was the beating heart of that Pacers team. He had built something of a legacy for himself in this playoff run. Just incredible. Four different times in this one playoffs, he made a game-tying or game-winning shot in the final few seconds of a game, including Game 1 of the NBA Finals. Just an incredible player. He strained his calf in Game 5, which is cause for concern, but he said he wanted to push through the injury and play. You know, it's the finals. But with 5 minutes to go in the first quarter of last night's game, he caught a pass, tried to cut past a defender, and his leg gave out. He crumpled to the floor. You could just immediately tell something was very wrong because he is screaming, he's pounding the floor with his fist. And sure enough, his dad later told the broadcast crew it was an Achilles injury.
Achilles. Okay, well, if that's a diagnosis, then he's not even the first big star to go down with that kind of injury these playoffs,
Exactly. Really third notable Achilles tear in this playoffs, and even more happened this past regular season. And a very similar thing actually happened to superstar Kevin Durant back in the 2019 NBA Finals. He missed the entire following season after that. And so it's a huge issue for the NBA. It's raising a lot of questions about what's contributing to these injuries, especially because a couple of these guys are really young. You know, Jason Tatum with the Boston Celtics, he's only 27. Haliburton's only 25. They've got to figure it out because losing stars, it's bad for fans, bad for business, just, you know, bad for everyone.
Yeah. That is NPR's Becky Sullivan. Thank you, Becky.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
Carol Moseley Braun had served for years in public office by the time she was elected to the U.S. Senate, so she felt she'd earned it, even if other people didn't.
They just weren't accustomed to seeing somebody look like me in those environments, and it's like I had worked hard to get there.
Carol Moseley Braun on her new memoir, Trailblazer, plus the latest on the war between Israel and Iran on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Trump administration is working to shut down the Department of Education.
Next, we'll look back at the department's birth just after the Civil War.
Basically, where soldiers set down their arms, school teachers need to pick up their books.
Plus, people in Iran react to the expanding conflict.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump on social media says Iran and Israel have agreed to a ceasefire, but neither country has confirmed that at this point. Iran launched a response attack today against a U.S. airbase in Qatar, but there were no reports of any injuries. Some Republicans are defending the president's decision to hit Iran's nuclear sites, while Democrats and other GOP lawmakers say the strikes were illegal because Trump didn't get approval from Congress in advance. Here's NPR's Tom Bowman.
Now, clearly, this is a reaction to the U.S. attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities. The big fear from defense officials and analysts was some of these bases in the Middle East would come under Iranian attack, and that's precisely what has happened here. But it's a limited attack, and some people are wondering, is this just messaging from Iran? They could have mounted a much more severe attack. Some are telling me that this could be just the beginning of Iranian attacks on Al Udeid and other bases in the Middle East.
NPR's Tom Bowman. A significant heat wave is settling over large parts of the East, Midwest, and South this week, with temperatures in the triple digits from member station WFAE. Stella Mackler reports it's raising concerns for folks without AC.
Carissa Carswell is enjoying the cool air blowing from an AC vent at a financial assistance center in Charlotte, North Carolina. Her air conditioning broke 4 days ago. She's been buying ice at Walmart to cool off, and she's worried about her kids.
It's survival. You can die like that. I ain't trying to be one of them, or my children.
While some cities require landlords to provide AC, most states, including North Carolina, do not. Advocates say this is a serious public health threat, and they're pushing for better protections. In the meantime, Carswell is considering leaving her home and staying with her mother. For NPR News, I'm Stella Mackler in Charlotte.
This is NPR. Movie audiences seem to be looking for comfort this weekend, even when it came to being scared. NPR's Bob Mondello has more on the weekend box office.
Four of the top five movies this weekend were either remakes, the live-action versions of How to Train Your Dragon.
Maybe they're not as bad as we think they are.
And Lilo and Stitch.
We have a blue dog to catch.
Or sequels, the horror film 28 Years Later. And Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning.
I need you to trust me one last time.
The only original picture to crack the top five, Elio, about a boy who dreams of being abducted by aliens.
It's really happening!
Comes from Pixar, but that reliable name in children's entertainment wasn't enough to make Elio fly. At $21 million in the U.S. and only $14 million overseas, the $150 million animated feature had the lowest opening in Pixar's history. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
A former Olympic swimmer and the first African took the helm today of the International Olympic Committee, the Olympic body celebrating its 131st birthday today, as Kirsty Coventry replaces Thomas Bach as IOC president. She's the first female to hold that position. She'll serve for the next 8 years, staging the upcoming Summer Olympics in Los Angeles in 2028. On Wall Street, the Dow gained more than 370 points today. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has wanted to attack Iran for decades. Initially, President Trump asked him to hold off, but all that has changed now. Israel has gone to war in Iran, and the U.S. decided to come along with him, striking Iran this past weekend. Then, today, President Trump announced on social media that Israel and Iran have reached a ceasefire, though neither country has confirmed that news. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
Benjamin Netanyahu warned about Iran's nuclear program for more than three decades. A decade ago at the United Nations, he held up a cartoon of a bomb and said Iran was inching closer to an advanced stage of uranium enrichment.
From there, it's only a few months, possibly a few weeks, before they get enough enriched uranium for the first bomb.
Iran has long threatened to destroy Israel. Netanyahu long wanted to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities, but couldn't get U.S. support. Ilan Goldenberg of the advocacy group J Street used to work at the Pentagon tracking Israel-Iran tensions under the Obama administration.
What we actually pursued during those years, and I think it's been really a consistent strategy for 20 years, from the United States, has been what you might call the hug and punch strategy. Demonstrate to the Israelis at every step of the way, we are capable of doing this much more effectively than you are, and we've got your back, and we will do it if we need to. And at the same time, don't you do it.
After President Trump announced nuclear talks with Iran this year, he said he asked Netanyahu to hold off on any attack. But by then, Israelis' own thinking had changed. Israel used to be deterred from attacking Iran by the threat of retaliation from Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Syrian regime. But those threats were beaten back in the last few years of war, and Israel got some practice rounds bombing Iran. Reuven Chazan teaches political science at Hebrew University.
Hamas is almost obliterated. Hezbollah has been hit so hard that they are sitting this one out. The Syrian regime has collapsed, and we were able to fly to Iran to take out their anti-aircraft missiles and to realize that now an operation like this can be done with little damage to us. So all of the chess pieces have moved, and while Netanyahu's been talking about this for decades, it is only in the last several months that this has all lined up for him and it's become possible.
Over the years, Netanyahu's focus on Iran has had other political advantages. Lior Sternfeld, a Mideast historian at Penn State University, says it helped Netanyahu distract from Israel's unresolved conflict with the Palestinians.
Because every critique on Israel behavior in the West Bank and Gaza, it was always convenient to have some kind of greater risk, not just to Israel, but to the world, in the form of Iran, in order to quiet critique.
The war on Iran also helped Netanyahu with problems at home. He averted his governing coalition from falling apart and sidelined widespread frustration with the Gaza war. Nadav Strauchler, a former advisor to Netanyahu, says as Trump considered whether to join in the Iran war, Netanyahu was well prepared for the moment.
The big trophy, the big idea, his big goal, his life mission was always Iran. So because he was so into it, it was, I think, easier for him to persuade Trump that this is the right thing to do.
This past weekend, the U.S. bombed Iran's main nuclear sites, and Netanyahu released this video.
Congratulations, President Trump. Your bold decision to target Iran's nuclear facilities with the awesome and righteous might of the United States will change history.
Whether Trump and Netanyahu will continue to be in lockstep is a question, especially over Gaza. In polls, Israelis overwhelmingly support Netanyahu's war in Iran, but the one success eluding him is ending the Gaza war and freeing the remaining hostages. And that is the open wound that hurts Israelis most. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
On the campaign trail, President Trump promised to carry out the largest deportation effort in U.S. history, focused on deporting people with criminal records. But now, immigration officials are also going after people seeking asylum. That's a legal process intended to protect those fleeing persecution. KJZZ's Wayne Shutsky reports on how the process has changed at immigration courts in Phoenix and around the country.
Nearly 900,000 people filed for asylum in the U.S. in 2024 and began navigating a complicated legal process to seek refuge in the United States. Lynn Marcus is the director of the Immigration Law Clinic at the University of Arizona.
So these include many people who have done things, quote, the right way, like they came in lawfully, they were processed in.
But she says the Trump administration is now using a new tactic to circumvent asylum seekers' due process rights.
And then when they showed up at their courts, all of a sudden there was this trickery.
Marcus says prosecutors with the Department of Homeland Security are asking immigration judges to dismiss asylum seekers' cases, claiming the federal government had no interest in pursuing them.
As they were leaving the courthouse, they were arrested, taken into custody, and then oftentimes just immediately deported.
Witnesses say they've seen this multiple times outside the Phoenix Immigration Court and other courts around the country. Protesters like Samantha Cooley gathered outside that court last month after immigration agents began detaining asylum seekers there.
I'm out here because how the Trump administration is doing anything they can to circumvent the law to deport immigrants without giving them their due process.
In an email, an ICE spokesperson says the agency is detaining people using what's called expedited removal, which allows fast-track deportations for people who have been in the country without legal status for less than 2 years. The spokesperson says anyone with a valid claim will continue in immigration proceedings. But Jessica K. David, a Phoenix immigration attorney, says reports of detentions are making some asylum seekers afraid to show up for their court dates. But if they skip their court date, that can be used to justify deportation.
All avenues are leading to deportation when you do have a real legal claim.
Federal law allows people who fear for their safety to seek asylum in the U.S. if they could show a credible fear of persecution in their home country. ICE officials did not respond to requests for an in-person interview. At a press conference in Los Angeles, Homeland Security Director Kristi Noem declined to directly address allegations that ICE is violating due process rights.
Here's the deal, guys. My job is not to pick and choose which laws we enforce and which ones we don't. We have laws in this country, and they matter.
President Trump won Arizona by more than 5 percentage points in 2024, in part by promising to ramp up deportations. And voters like Mario Fishback say this new immigration policy is what they voted for.
He's doing a good job. It's not easy. You have to be flexible, and I think he's being flexible in a good way.
But critics, including Democratic Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs, say Trump is going well beyond what he promised on the campaign trail.
I want ICE to go after the criminals. I want them to focus on those deportations. That's what President Trump ran on. And now they're targeting people who are just trying to comply with the law.
Lynn Marcus, the law professor, says she fears the administration is using these tactics to meet its goal of deporting 1 million people this year.
So the idea is, if you can skirt due process and interpret the laws in ways that are as restrictive as possible, then you can get your numbers.
The Trump administration said it had deported around 200,000 people by the end of May. That pace suggests it's behind the president's goal to deport 1 million people without legal status this year. For NPR News, I'm Wayne Shutsky in Phoenix.
This is NPR News. Sometimes history lies hidden just around the corner. Stroll through London's financial district and you might come across the vine-draped ruins of a church bombed during the Blitz. South of Washington, D.C., down the Potomac River, is a graveyard with more than 100 wooden ships that date to World War I. It's called the Ghost Fleet of Mallows Bay, and it is the largest site of its kind in the Western Hemisphere. NPR's Frank Langfitt went exploring and filed this audio postcard.
So I'm just paddling up to this ship. The gunwales are at least 2 to 3 feet out of the water, and it's basically an island full of foliage. I mean, the bushes are 6, 7 feet, and a bird just flew right past me. It's like a little park sitting in the carcass of a ship that's over 100 years old.
I call them flower pots.
Susan Langley is the Maryland State underwater archaeologist. She's guiding me through a maze of mostly sunken ships about 40 miles south of Washington.
It's best to come here around low tide. That's when you can easily see the gunwales, the top edges of the hulls, which, as Langley describes, became flower pots that can stretch for nearly several hundred feet.
They just get filled with soil, and then the seeds blow in or the birds drop them, and they turn into islands. Used to be when the trees reached a decent height, the beavers would take them down. There were deer that were living on them.
Deer were living on the islands?
Deer were living on some of the ships back in the 90s.
How did most of these ships end up here? The story begins in 1917, World War I. German U-boats and mines were sinking lots of steel cargo ships. So the government tried to replace some of them by building wooden steamships. Langley explains the thinking.
Cheap and easy. We had lots of wood. All the metal was going to military watercraft.
But the ships ran into construction problems and had mechanical failures. Just a year later, the war ended. Salvagers stripped the ships for parts, burned the hulls to the waterline, left them to rot. Not just here in Mallows Bay, but in other spots around the country.
They're in James River, there's Hampton Roads, the Natchez River near Beaumont, Texas, and there's about 18 or more up in Baltimore.
Over time, the hulls deteriorated and sank into the muck. This was, let's be honest, a watery junkyard. But then, nature took over, and it transformed these worthless hulks into something remarkable.
So I'm paddling into a lagoon right now, and I have, and what it is, it's formed by three separate ships. And the only way you can tell is if you look down, you can see the gunnels.
That sound you hear is water dripping from the hull. At first, I'm confused. Why is the ship dripping? I turn to Shelley Perry. Perry owns Atlantic Kayak Company here in Charles County, Maryland, and she's out with us today.
So where's the water coming from?
It's coming from the ship. It's a wetland.
It's a wetland.
Now, I get it. It's low tide, and the ship is draining. The ghost fleet is one with the bay. I paddle towards another ship.
There are two red-winged blackbird nests on a tree that's sticking out of one of the gunwales of the ship. Oh, there they go. In a sense, the ships are much more alive today than they were when they were built. Like, they serve more of a purpose.
History can be funny that way. A failed shipbuilding project is now a unique marine heritage site, which the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says is the only one of its kind in this half of the globe. People come out with Atlantic Kayak to tour Mallows Bay during the weekends. But most of the time, this place is empty. Frank Langford, NPR News, Mallows Bay.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. School and the federal government's role in it has been a topic of debate in this country since the very first Department of Education was created. Rund Abdel-Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei, the hosts of NPR's Throughline podcast, bring us the story of the department's birth in the wake of the Civil War. And a note, this story includes archival text read by voice actors.
On June 8, 1866, James Garfield, a representative from Ohio, takes the floor to make the case for something that the nation had never seen before, a national department of education.
Schoolhouses are less expensive than rebellions. A tenth of our national debt expended in public education 50 years ago would have saved us the blood and treasure of the late war. A far less sum may save our children from still greater calamity.
Garfield was speaking to a Congress that looked very different than it had just a few years prior. The Civil War had just ended. Reconstruction had begun. Even the building was undergoing a renovation. At this point, many Southern lawmakers had left or had been expelled by Congress during the Civil War and were not even in the room when Garfield spoke. The hard work of rebuilding the country was beginning. Garfield and others argued that teachers should lead the way.
School teachers are going to be the ones that are able to rebuild Southern culture and rebuild our society in a way that is more cohesive.
This is Michael Studeman. He's an assistant professor of rhetoric at Penn State University who studies the history of education policy in the U.S.
Basically, where soldiers set down their arms, school teachers need to pick up their books.
And the need was urgent. The 13th Amendment abolishing slavery had just been ratified in 1865, and the 14th Amendment granting equal protection was on its way.
And the greatest clamor coming from 4 million people who were enslaved in the South is this demand that they be properly educated to become citizens of this country.
This is Christopher Spann. He's a historian of American education.
And it's amazing because it's not just the 4 million newly freed people that they're working with.
Many white people in the South also had no schooling.
Particularly poor Southern whites, so people that did not have plantations, did not have slaves, did not have access to the money and wealth.
At this point, the South had virtually no schools compared to the North, and James Garfield saw this as an opportunity.
Congress reconvened after the Civil War, and there was a sort of flurry of proposals that it was like everybody was ready with all these plans for, like, how are we going to do Reconstruction? Let's go.
Education was important for cultural reasons, and also for very practical ones.
Any hope they had of a meaningful political coalition in the South depended on Black people having the right to vote and the right to participate in politics.
And the Radical Republicans, a faction of the Republican Party committed to fighting for equal treatment of the formerly enslaved, had every intention of enfranchising Southern Black people. So things that we might consider very basic education today, knowing how to count, being able to read and write, were essential.
That you can read the ballot and be able to vote for the candidate that you want to because you have enough literacy to be able to select that correctly.
Which brings us back to that June day in 1866. Garfield opens up the debate in the House by describing his vision for a federal Department of Education.
That there shall be established at the city of Washington a Department of Education for the purpose of collecting such statistics and facts as shall show the condition and progress of education in the several states and territories.
Going into the debate, Garfield knows that he has to tread carefully, because up until this point, local communities handled their own education systems.
So his position was, if we come out with a Bureau of Education that tries to impose upon the country its will, that tries to say to states, here's how you're going to educate, people will reject that. That was his opinion.
But he had a plan for that. The department would gather statistics. At this time, statistics was an emerging science that Garfield fully embraced.
In his view, statistics were basically like interpreting God's word, in a sense. This is revealing the shape of the social world to us so that we can make very wise political decisions. So he had a ton of faith in what could happen if schools were approached in a way that emphasized statistics.
According to the census of 1860, there were 1,200,000 inhabitants in the United States over 21 years of age who could not read nor write, and 800,000 of those were American-born citizens.
One by one, the Republicans step onto the floor to make their case for the Department of Education.
Civilization is nothing more than education.
The very object of establishing a Bureau of Education is that these different systems may be brought together.
We thus strike out at one blow a large proportion of the ignorance of the South. We shame the whites into an effort to educate themselves, and we prepare thus both classes for the proper exercise of the right of suffrage.
We want all these school systems all over the land brought under one head so that they may be nationalized, vitalized, and made uniform and harmonious as far as possible.
But not everyone was on board with these ideas.
I am content, sir, to leave this matter of education where our fathers left it, where the history of this country has left it, to the school systems of the different towns, cities, and states. Let them carry out and regulate the system of education without interference.
Southern Democrats weren't present, so it was Northern Democrats who were making these comments.
And many of them come from school communities where local control is the ultimate form of control.
The Democrats that were left in the room pointed out that a federal education department was never written into the Constitution. And after hearing all the radical Republicans talk about just how much this new department would do to change the country, well, they didn't like the idea of handing the federal government so much power. And so they feared what the radical Republicans would end up doing if the Department of Education was established.
That this was going to empower the federal government to have an undue influence on what children learned in the classroom.
In the end, the radical Republicans prevail. The following year, President Andrew Johnson signs the bill. The first Department of Education comes into existence on March 2, 1867. It would be made up of one commissioner, three clerks, and a small budget of $15,000, roughly $300,000 today. And it would only last about a year.
That was NPR's Throughline team. You can listen to their full episode wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at CIDQ.
Chuck Berry and Bill Diddley together.